Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella. On Saturday, May 31st, guest conductor James Gaffigan and the orchestra are joined by guest soloist soprano Janai Brugger. The program includes The American, a suite in A by Antonín Dvořák, by Leonard Bernstein, three dance episodes from On the Town, as well as the overture to Candide, George Gershwin's An American in Paris, and with Janai Brugger, songs by Florence Price and two portions of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on the Dvořák suite in A major, The American, the performance time around 22 minutes. These are the first Chicago Symphony Orchestra performances. Dvořák has arrived, ran a headline in the Chicago Daily Tribune on August 12, 1893. The composer, his wife, and their children took up residence at the new Lakota Hotel on the corner of Michigan Avenue and 30th Street. Dvořák was the first of the famous European composers to visit Chicago. Theodore Thomas, who founded the Chicago Symphony and then called the Chicago Orchestra just 2 years earlier, had invited Dvořák to conduct the orchestra at the World's Columbian Exposition in a concert honoring Bohemian Day. Thomas, the Tribune said, has done more than any other American conductor to introduce Dvořák's music here. Here, meaning the United States. Thomas arranged to send a string quartet to Dvořák's hotel to read through a new quartet, now known as The American, and considered one of Dvořák's signature works, which the composer had just completed in Spillville, Iowa, the largely Czech community where he spent the summer of 1893. Festival Hall was packed on August 12th. The amphitheater seated 4,000 with standing room for another 2,000. As Dvořák walked upon the stage, a storm of applause greeted him, the Chicago Tribune reported. Dvořák conducted his G major symphony, now known as the Eighth, then called Number 4, three of his popular Slavonic dances, and to close the concert, the overture My Country. After leaving Chicago, the Dvořáks traveled to Minnesota to see Minnehaha Falls, featured in Longfellow's The Song of Hiawatha, which had inspired passages in the recently completed New World Symphony that no one had yet heard. Early the next winter, while still temporarily living in New York City, Dvořák put more of his impressions of America on paper, this time in the form of a suite for piano. It is that music, which he orchestrated the following year, that became the suite performed at this concert. Like the string quartet composed shortly before the composer's Chicago visit, it was later given the subtitle American. Following the New World Symphony and the quartet, it is the regularly overlooked final part of a trio of works that record Dvořák's time in this country. The suite was not performed until 1910, 6 years after the composer's death. There are five movements, each of them a postcard of the composer's American experience, an outsider's view of a rich musical land. The entire suite has a loose, informal quality, but it is quietly organized by recurring motifs and the pull of A major. The language is what we've come to recognize as uniquely Dvořák's, a kaleidoscope of various kinds of music indebted to both his European background, the middle movement is marked a la Polacca in the manner of a Polonaise, and at the same time influenced by the melodies, harmonies, and rhythms he heard in the New World. There are snatches of Native American dance and black spirituals. Where the fourth movement suggests the big skies and vast desolate stretches of the Iowa prairie, the opening andante rarely strays from braided rug and rocking chair hominess. That simplicity and honesty is part of the music's overall charm. Program notes by Philip Pusher on the suite in A major, The American, by Antonín Dvořák. And now on to George Gershwin's An American in Paris, a work lasting about 17 minutes. Gershwin's music has always been so popular that it's easy to overlook his classical roots. His first musical memory was of an automatic piano in a penny arcade on 125th Street playing Anton Rubinstein's Melody in F, one of those rare pieces that had become a popular classic, giving Gershwin the idea at an early age that serious and commercial music could be one and the same. As a teenager, Gershwin attended recitals by celebrity soloists such as Joseph Levine and Ephraim Zimbalist. He played piano in the Beethoven Society Orchestra at Public School 63, and he studied music theory as well as piano. Even after George quit school at 15 to become probably the youngest piano pounder ever employed in Tin Pan Alley, he didn't forget his greater ambitions. In the early 20s, while Gershwin was turning out a steady stream of hits and making the kind of money that is unheard of in the classical music business, he was more determined than ever to write serious music that was equally popular. The historic premiere of Rhapsody in Blue at New York's Aeolian Theater in 1924 announced to the music world that Gershwin was a far more complex and ambitious musician than a mere songwriter. And just to confuse matters, that same year, Gershwin produced some of his finest songs, including Fascinating Rhythm. During the mid-1920s, while he enjoyed the life of a rich celebrity, collecting modern art and moving his family out of their dreary apartment into a five-story townhouse on the Upper West Side, Gershwin began to compose a piano concerto, three piano preludes, and this tone poem, A Love Song to Paris, while still maintaining his roles as pianist, tunesmith, and conductor. In January 1928, Gershwin accepted an invitation to visit friends in Paris. Recognizing the need for a change from the frenetic New York scene, he currently had two hit shows, Funny Face and Rosalie, running simultaneously, Gershwin immediately started thinking about a rhapsodic ballet, which he quickly titled An American in Paris. By the time he and his brother Ira boarded a steamer for Europe on March 9th, George had already sketched the piece in versions for one and two pianos. Gershwin arrived in Paris as famous as any living musician. A dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker, Gershwin was dazzled by this great cosmopolitan city. Looking down from the top of the Eiffel Tower, he was positively dizzy. To Gershwin, Paris had always been a city of music, and now, in his mind, it was Ravel's city. These two famous, successful composers had just met at Ravel's 53rd birthday party the previous month in New York City. Ravel specifically asked that Gershwin be invited. They hit it off at once. Gershwin played the piano until 4 a.m., and Ravel stayed to the very end. Another night, the two went off to hear jazz in Harlem. In Paris, Gershwin continued to work on the score of his new piece, and he spent one entire afternoon shopping the auto supply stores on the Avenue de la Grande Armée in search of the ideal car horns for the traffic scene he had in mind. He took four horns home with him for the New York premiere. At the time, Gershwin told a reporter that An American in Paris was written very freely and is the most modern music I've yet attempted. It's certainly Gershwin's most accomplished and ambitious orchestral work to date. For the first time, Gershwin's trademark jazzy rhythms, bluesy harmonies, and unforgettable melodies are all woven into a big, sophisticated work of symphonic dimensions. By 1928, Gershwin had developed a fine ear for orchestral color and a sense of cinematic panorama. Despite his claim that he hadn't written program music, the play-by-play scenario printed in the score and often quoted is by Deems Taylor, not Gershwin, the work is unforgettably descriptive. From its opening walking music, think Gene Kelly, Hollywood 1951, to the car-honking traffic jam. Gershwin did identify the American's spasm of homesickness after too many drinks in a street cafe, but neither he nor Taylor managed to explain the hot Caribbean rhythm midway through. An American in Paris was a hit at its New York premiere just months after Gershwin came home, and inevitably, it was soon loved in Paris, too. Program notes by Philip Huscher on George Gershwin's An American in Paris. And now on to Leonard Bernstein's Candide Overture. The work lasts about 5 minutes. As a composer, Leonard Bernstein was equally at home in the concert hall and the music theater. He wrote works for each venue and a great many pieces that combined stylistic traits from both traditions. Throughout his life, Bernstein championed the idea that a true American music, by definition, should be eclectic, and he never thought of that word as pejorative, though he often wondered why others did. But the way Bernstein regularly merged both popular and serious styles within the same work regularly drew fierce criticism. Nevertheless, he proudly persisted in his efforts to marry the high and the low, or the light and the serious. Candide was one of his greatest successes in this mission, and also one of his biggest flops. Nearly 200 years separate Voltaire's novel Candide, or Optimism, from the musical by Bernstein and Lillian Hellman, and by 1956, the concept of the best of all possible worlds had become particularly elusive. The show itself was troubled almost from the start, even though it inspired some of Bernstein's wisest and wittiest music. Candide ran for 73 performances, a serious failure by Broadway standards. For a new opera, on the other hand, the figure would be staggering. Hellman eventually called Candide her most unpleasant experience in the theater, and Tyrone Guthrie, who directed, dismissed it as an artistic and financial disaster. Still, the original cast album became a cult recording, and over the next few years, a number of believers, including Stephen Sondheim, persisted in their attempts to rewrite, redecorate, and revive the show, sometimes as an operetta, sometimes as grand opera, and even as pure Broadway musical once again. The brilliant overture, virtually alone among Candide's many numbers, has emerged unscathed from the experience. It remains one of the most affecting of Bernstein's creations, a charming and sassy curtain raiser based on two of the show's best tunes, O Happy We and Cunegonda's jewel song, Glitter and Be Gay. Bernstein himself once called it a Valentine to European music. Above all, it is delightful evidence of Bernstein's belief that man's capacity for laughter is nobler than his divine gift of suffering. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Leonard Bernstein's Candide Overture. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.